This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening, and thank you for tuning in to Eco Radio. On tonight's program, we'll speak with Mickey Huff from Project Censored. But first, this is Naturally, and I have your news. EcoWatch.com reports, need more evidence of the impact of climate change on the Earth? The National Climatic Data Center of the United States and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration reports that the global temperature in October was the hottest on record. The average combined temperature was 58.43 Fahrenheit, compared to the 20th century average of 57.1 degrees Fahrenheit. That beat the previous October record set in 2003 by 0.02 degrees Fahrenheit. Most of the globe saw a warmer October, including the U.S. Pacific coast, already suffering from multi-year drought. Other record highs were logged in southern South America, Far East Russia, parts of southern and southeastern Asia, much of the southern and western Australia, and some of southern Europe. The contiguous United States has its fourth hottest October since national records began, with temperatures overall 3 degrees Fahrenheit above the 20th century average. And the planet is on track for the hottest year ever. From January through October, the combined land and ocean average surface temperature was the warmest on record, eclipsing the previous record years of 1998 and 2010. The average combined temperature was 58.43 degrees Fahrenheit, compared to the 20th century average at 57.1 degrees Fahrenheit. The NewYorkTimes.com reports, the EPA quietly announced on Friday that after much delay, it had been unable to decide this year on a rule-setting levels for the amount of biofuel it would require to be blended into conventional vehicle fuels. Because of the delay, a spokeswoman said in a statement, the agency will not take up the rule, known as the Renewable Fuel Standards, until next year when it seeks to set levels for 2015 and 2016. The decision not to decide is the latest setback in a long line of economic, legal, and logistical hurdles the agency has faced since it started requiring increasing levels of ethanol to be incorporated into vehicle fuel under energy laws passed in 2005 and 2007. Much has changed since then, when American dependence on foreign oil was high and so were prices. Now, however, the country is awash in domestic oil from shale drilling, while more efficient cars and an anemic economy have cut demand. The market is saturated with regular corn ethanol, while production of cellulosic or so-called advanced biofuel made from non-food parts of corn plants or other biomass like wood waste has fallen short of what the mandate requires refiners to use. On Friday, supporters and opponents of increased biofuel production expressed a rare consensus that the EPA's move was a punt and that the rule needed to be fixed whether they were in favor of revision or repeal. Others said that this latest wrinkle was a clear sign that Congress should revisit the law. EcoWatch.com reports, despite strong opposition from both elected officials in the affected areas and environmental groups, the U.S. Forest Service, or the USFS, has approved fracking in George Washington Forest. The forest, located in Virginia and West Virginia, is the largest national forest on the East Coast. It contains the headwaters of the Potomac River, which feed into the Chesapeake Bay and provide drinking water for millions of people in the Washington, D.C. and Chesapeake area region. The USFS has initially proposed to ban fracking in the 1.1 million acre forest, the first outright ban of the practice in a national forest. But when the plan was released in 2011, energy companies complained and exerted pressure on the USFS. About 10,000 acres of the forest are already been leased to oil and gas companies, with private mineral rights existing under another 167,000 acres. The newly released plan will only allow fracking on that land, which is located in sparsely populated rural Highland County, Virginia. The plan also puts off limits another 800,000 acres that were available for drilling. Quote, we think we've ended up in a much better place, which is we are allowing oil and gas drilling. Robert Bonney, the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Undersecretary for Natural Resources and Environment, told the Associated Press, quote, from a policy perspective, the Forest Service allows fracking on forest lands throughout the country. We didn't want to make a policy decision or change policy related to fracking. This decision is about where it's appropriate to do oil and gas leaking, end quote. quote, allowing the use of fracking within a part of the George Washington National Forest is part of the Obama administration's embrace of oil and gas drilling, despite the water, air, and climate pollution that is proven to come along with it, end quote, said Earthworks Energy Program Director Bruce Basil. He goes on to say, quote, this administration continues to promote an all of the above energy policy rather than a swift transition to renewable energy. The president can protect the climate and public health, or he can continue to promote fracking. He cannot do both, end quote. The USFS says before any drilling takes place, there will be a public comment period, and the decision is subject to appeal. That's all for our news today. I believe we have our caller on the air.
Yeah, I believe we do. We have Mickey Huff with Project Censored on the air. Are you there, Mickey?
I am here. Thanks so much for inviting me on the program today.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm glad you were able to join us. So first of all, I want to maybe step through the environmental stories. You guys put out an annual list of most censored stories, and it seems several this year are of an environmental bend, so I want to step through those. But before we do that, I don't want to make any assumptions that our listeners may know about Project Censored or they may not know. So maybe you could start by telling us a little bit about Project Censored, like a brief history, and then also maybe some of the methodology you go about in picking this annual list.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. Project Censored is a nonprofit media research organization. We specialize in being sort of an academic critic of what we call the corporate news media and news media coverage in the United States. We were founded in 1976 at Sonoma State University in Northern California. And Professor Carl Jensen, the founder of Project Censored, has a background in communications and journalism. And he started the project by asking what the news media was missing, or what. And again, most people use the term mainstream media. We tend to use the word corporate media because much of the ubiquitous media that people readily watch is actually corporate in its orientation and ownership. And in fact, since the 1980s, ownership of the news media in the United States has gone from 50 corporations to about 6. And so that's part of the problem that we analyze. But Carl started to look at the issue of Watergate and asked, well, why didn't the Washington Post or other outlets get onto Watergate sooner? Because it was actually being reported about in alternative and independent publications prior to Nixon's landslide reelection in 1972. And again, what Jensen found is that the alternative media was covering some of these stories, but the corporate media tended to lag behind about 18 months to 2 years. And he asked this question, well, I wonder what would happen if more people knew the things that were being written about in independent and alternative media in a timely fashion. I wonder how it might impact the outcomes of our elections, or, you know, impact the way people participate in American politics. And so for 20 years, Carl oversaw the project, having students research stories in class where they look at sort of a hodgepodge of independent news publications. And once upon a time, those were all hard copy, right, sent to the university. And, of course, nowadays everything's mostly online, so we can do that. But what happens is Jensen would have and his successor, Peter Phillips, a sociologist that took over thereafter. I've been the director for about 5 years now, taking over from Peter. But what we do is we have students research these stories, and we try to find out with LexisNexis or ProQuest databases, where have they been covered? Have they gotten corporate news attention? Have they been out in the so-called mainstream? If so, where and how? If not, why not? And then we highlight those stories, and they're factually vetted by professors and experts in the area that the story addresses topically. And right now, we review about 230 to 250 stories a year. They go through a validating process that I just described. We had, in our last cycle, our last book, Censored 2015, Inspiring We the People, 260 college students, 49 professors on 18 colleges and universities around the United States. So we've come a long way from being a project in a classroom at Sonoma State University to now being on upwards of 20 campuses across the U.S. We have a weekly radio show on Pacifica Radio, a new documentary film. So we're really trying to take our media literacy and critical thinking message directly to the public, and hopefully we have some more outreach outside of one small classroom.
Oh, wow. So, yeah, things have really grown. And we've aired the Project Censored radio program here a couple times here on KKFI, mm-hmm. as we've had openings.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's It's a good program,
yeah,
it's very interesting.
Great to be on there. Anytime we can get on, it's always a good thing.
Yeah, I hear you. All right, so you put out this new list, and let's count down from 25 down to 1. The first one I see that is of environmental in nature is number 19 on the list. It's agribusiness giants attempt to silence and discredit scientists whose research reveals herbicides health threats. What can you tell us about that?
This is an ongoing problem. These are more specific cases from the last year. And these stories were originally published in GM Watch, also the Corbett Report, and even in the New Yorker. So we saw, and we also saw a great story on Democracy Now. And in fact, I'm going to start with that one because that one is pretty amazing. These involve big agribusiness, and of course, your listeners that are familiar with the subject will certainly know the names of Monsanto, and they probably have heard of Syngenta too, although they seem to be lesser known than Monsanto. But they certainly share interests in GMO kinds of technologies and so forth. And they also both spend an awful lot of money researching and, you know, trying to advance their products and advance the things that they do, particularly the GM crops that they have. You know, the case of Tyrone Hayes at University of California, Berkeley, he's a professor of biology, and he was looking at Syngenta's herbicide. It's called atrazine, and, of course, he had a history. He left Syngenta in 2001. But he kept researching what he saw as harmful effects of atrazine on the endocrine system. And so basically Hayes was doing this at Syngenta, but when his findings began to point this out, Syngenta distanced themselves from him. They wouldn't let him publish his results. So they basically censored him, claiming that they owned the research. And then when he was at UC Berkeley, they tried to use their pressure on the university to silence him there. And claim that he wasn't allowed to report these things, and he had ulterior motives and agendas. And I mean, it's really a serious effort to muzzle, you know, a PhD researcher who's showing that atrazine, which is still on the market, has significant adverse environmental and health impacts on the population. I mean, that's one case. Another involving Monsanto, and that's Monsanto seems to always, you know, be on the list year after year, whether it's their genetically modified corn with herbicides, you know, having questionable effects on rats, or, you know, going back to Vietnam with Monsanto and Agent Orange. You know, they've consistently not only been a potential problem for the environment and human health impact, they've also been a big player in Washington. They're one of the biggest, if not the biggest, annual contributor from big agribusiness to lobbyists on K Street and certainly in Washington. And there's often a revolving door between executives and attorneys at Monsanto and things like the FDA. So these are ongoing problems. And at Project Censored, unfortunately, we've had to cover them for a couple of decades, including the big Fox News Monsanto case of the late 1990s involving Posilac and hormones in the milk supply.
Yeah, I do remember that. And didn't that involve a lawsuit where they tried?
Oh, yeah. That was a doozy of a story involving Steve Wilson and Jane Akrey, who were journalists at Fox News Tampa, Florida.
Right.
And they did this scientific expose and dotted the I's and crossed the T's, and everything kept fact-checking and checking out in the end. But there was an attorney at Monsanto that kept saying they were going to sue, and they found out because they had somebody that sat on the board at Monsanto that also sat on the board of News Corp, which owns Fox News. And they found out that they were going to do this story, and Monsanto threatened to sue. And even when the story fact-checked, the owner of the station said, "We paid $3.5 billion for these news stations. We'll tell you what the news is." And they basically bribed Akrey and Wilson. This was in the late 90s, and they told them they would pay them a couple hundred thousand dollars each to keep their mouths shut. They didn't. They blew the whistle, but Florida has such weak whistleblower laws that even though they won their first case against Monsanto, they lost on appeal, and all the other major news media outlets filed an amicus to the court, a friend of the court brief, saying Monsanto should have the right and Fox should have the right to lie to the public if it hurts their shareholders. And Wilson and Acri not only lost their jobs, but they ultimately lost the case, and it sits on the books as one of the cases used to say that private corporate media, even though they publish media that everybody needs to see and watch, are allowed to censor it and curtail it on the basis of how it affects their shareholders.
Wow. Yeah, that story is emblematic of why an organization like yours is needed to keep an eye on those kind of things and point some of this out. I want to go down to another one on the list, going down to number 17. Now, here's something that's been covered on our radio station before, but not on Eco Radio KC. We don't really talk about Gaza on Eco Radio, but there's an issue there with clean drinking water. What's going on there?
There are so many issues going on with Gaza, particularly after the siege this past summer from Israel. But there have been long-standing issues in Gaza with the blockade, with food getting in, calorie counts, sterilizing immigrants coming into Gaza. This story in particular, which may seem moot now in the wake of the bombings of the summer, but this story is a study that estimated that about one quarter of disease in Gaza resulted from contaminated water supplies. And this story was originally on Al Jazeera, and it was covered in The Independent, that's in England. But the story is that they're running out of clean drinking water, and the date is by 2016, Gaza will be running out of clean water. And in fact, 95% of the water in Gaza, according to the World Health Organization, doesn't meet global standards for human consumption. And so this is a pretty serious problem, given that Gazans are pretty much shelled in. I mean, they're kind of walled in. They can't really come and go. They don't have a lot of mobility. And, of course, any other countries that try to get in to help the Gazans are seen as somehow acting against Israeli interests, and that's not a very political popular thing in the West and in Western Europe anyway. So it's really kind of a problem on top of a series of problems surrounding Israel-Palestine. And, again, right now the UN has estimated that over three-quarters of Gazans have to buy drinking water because they can't get access to it any other way. And eventually that's going to be a problem. Of course, they can't grow crops. They're suffering a drought. And now literally it's turning into a problem in terms of, people are just going to be out of drinking water. And that's something that one would think would be a human right. But unfortunately, that story is getting overlooked, and it's a very serious problem for people living there.
So I'm looking here at what it said here. The coastal aquifer Zander Swinburne reported is contaminated with sewage, chemicals, and seawater. So, they're kind of like, stuck in their own filth in a lot of ways. Do you think this is a direct result of occupation, or is it more complicated than that? Or,
well, there's discrimination in water allocation. That's one of the issues that we've seen reported, and it's again the Palestinians don't have access to the things that they might need to improve their situation, to improve their access to water, because again they're hemmed in and they oft are not permitted to receive external assistance or help. And again, this relates back to a few years ago when there was a blockade based on a daily caloric intake in terms of importing food to Palestine, where they weren't even meeting minimal levels because the food was being prevented from being sent in.
That's incredible.
Okay. It's incredible given how few people seem to talk about it. I could say that for sure. It's a really devastating story.
It sure is, and of course, obviously, it's a human rights story, but it's All right. Well, let's move on to number 16 on the list: the beef industry's feedlot feedback loop. What is meant by feedlot feedback loop?
Well, this is a story, again, the beef industry has been in the news for various reasons over the years, whether it's their battle with Oprah Winfrey or some other agency, looking to kind of call them out on their practices, whether for mad cow disease and wasting of water and environmental degradation. This is a strange story, though, because it involves also the poultry industry and something called poultry litter, which is basically what's on the bottom of the chicken coops and chicken floors and, you know, this kind of thing. So it's basic, you know, it's a lot of, you know, savory matter here.
Waste.
Yeah. So, but the point is that a lot of what the chickens are fed, and especially in these factory farms and these corporate factory farms, they're actually fed parts of other animals. Some of them fed parts of cattle, and then of course that goes through, some of it's either on the floor or it goes through their system and it comes out, you know, as chicken fecal matter. And then this. This poultry litter is literally scraped up, and it's used as feed for cows. And, of course, that's been connected to mad cow disease, something we don't hear a lot about anymore. But that's what it means, feedlot feedback loop, is that one set of animals is fed one thing and fed dead remains of one thing, and then they excrete it out or have waste on the floor, and then they use that and scrap that up and use it as feed in other, you know, for other animals. And in this case, it's taking chicken poultry litter and feeding it to cattle. So that's a real problem. And the USDA tests less than 1% of the over 30 million cattle that are slaughtered annually. So there's not really an intense oversight here. And, in fact, there's a related issue that we covered in the story. You could read about this in Rolling Stone or on Earth. And, again, if you go to projectcensored.org, you can see the listing of stories and you can access them for free. We urge people to do that and see the schools and professors and students that are helping research and vet these stories. But there was another interesting story of the USDA allowing the poultry industry to speed up how many birds they process a minute from 140 to 175. And the more they process, the more profit, but the more they process, the more people might get hurt, the less likely they are to catch things that are problems. I mean, it's a real problem. And in fact, the USDA there was a ruling this summer. They tried to grandfather in the 175 birds per minute processing rate to those people that were actually testing the speed. So they were allowed to continue that, but overall the USDA said no. As of this summer, they were not going to exceed the 140 birds per minute due to the reasons that I just explained. But, you know, this sounds like an historic issue for some people. When you hear the word mad cow, right, people remember, oh, mad cow, I remember that. What happened to that? Well, it's coming back, and part of this is due to the beef industry's feedlot feedback loop with poultry litter.
So is part of the problem this – I mean – is this like just typical, the corporate journalism is afraid of offending potential advertisers, or are people extra, media outlets extra intimidated because it's the beef industry? You alluded to the Oprah Winfrey issue. So for our listeners that don't know, she had on a guest many years ago called Howard Lyman. He was known as the Mad Cowboy. He was a rancher in Montana that had become vegan and was going around and speaking about the concerns with the meat industry. And so he was on Oprah's show, and Oprah said, you know, after, I don't know whether they showed a video or something, Oprah said, I'll never eat another hamburger again. And then they were both sued by, was it the Texas Cattlemen's Association or something?
That's right. That is correct.
And so that's food disparagement laws, I think, is what they're called.
Yes.
Where you know, there's like pretty much gag orders in effect. These are state laws normally. Gag orders in effect that prevent folks from raising concerns about food if it will impact sales of said food. Is that what it's saying?
Yeah, absolutely. And this was a huge issue. And, I mean, look, Oprah Winfrey. I mean, everybody knows Oprah Winfrey, you know. And this is these cattle groups are quite litigious, and they definitely want to silence critics. And so, yes, you mentioned, is this an issue of media not wanting to offend advertisers? Well, look, it's Tyson Chicken. It's the beef industry. I mean, these are major advertisers, major funders. They own major stock in some of the same companies that own media. And by the way, they also have people that sit in regulatory agencies in the federal government that try to contest that there's any problem going on with these practices. So I'm afraid we're up against multiple forces here. And, you know, again, the easiest way to avoid any of this kind of contamination is to go local, go organic, go grass-fed, go to the farmers markets, you know, really try to be a conscious consumer of food products if you don't raise the food yourself. And, you know, that's one of the easiest ways to try to get around this or avoid this because, again, it's a real serious corporate juggernaut of forces between cattle, between beef, the USDA, and the corporate news media. You know, you really won't hear a lot of how these things are problems because they don't want to advertise on a network where someone's going to call that out. And you just said, again, you take a look at what happened to Oprah Winfrey and you say, wow, if that can happen to her, wow, she's big.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll go after a target like that and not even sweat it. So, you know, somebody smaller, a smaller publication or a researcher, they'll get shut down really quickly.
Right, and it's not like Oprah or Howard Lyman were in Texas even when they uttered the statement. It's just that their show was broadcast in Texas.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, which goes to show how litigious and active they are
right.
In terms of, like, really pushing that envelope. They'll go after anybody to silence it. And then what you're left in the wake is the chilling effect, right?
Right.
The self-censorship. Like, wow, I can't afford to handle what happened to Oprah. I better not report this feedlot feedback story.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Kind of preemptive gag.
Yeah.
So we're going to take a quick break, Mickey. We'll be right back after these messages.
Sure, thanks.
This week on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
When the culture collapses, what's left are the regular folk. And who the folk are the people of the earth, the people that kept close to the earth. They survived the collapses, and they continue to tell the stories.
I'm Neil Harvey. Join us for Why the World Doesn't End with mythologist Michael Mead on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Friday morning at 9:30, right before Eclectic.
If your unemployment benefits have been denied in the last 30 days, you may be eligible for free legal assistance from attorneys and law students through the UMKC School of Law Unemployment Benefits Clinic. To find out if you are eligible for these free legal services, your unemployment benefits must have been denied in the last 30 days. Contact the clinic today and talk to an attorney about your case free of charge. Call 816-235-5129. Again, call 816-235-5129.
All right, back in the studio here. My name is Mike Murphy. Natural E is here with me, and we're talking to Mickey Huff on the phone. Mickey's the director of Project Censored?
Yeah, I'm the director of Project Censored and Media Freedom Foundation in Northern California.
All right. And so they put out a list every year that we've been stepping through, a list of news that didn't make the news, as you guys put it.
Actually, we do a book. Our Seven Stories Press publishes a whole book. We do an entire book on these stories and many other media-related matters every year.
Yeah, that's great. And the website is projectcensored.org, see if you can find out more information there. So we're stepping through the list, Mickey. I'm now down to number 14. Accumulating evidence of ongoing wireless technology health hazards. That's an environmental issue, it sounds like. What do you want to tell us about that?
Well, it is, and it's actually it's somewhat controversial because a lot of people disagree with the idea that radio frequencies and electromagnetic fields are causes of health problems, but more and more, as the years go on, studies of long-term use of wireless phones has been connected to a rise of certain kinds of brain tumors. And, of course, the World Health Organization has determined that RF-EMF, that's radio frequency or electromagnetic fields, they are a possible human carcinogen. Now, of course, some researchers say that they definitely are. Some say, well, maybe they're not. But the WHO is now putting it on a list of things that they're paying closer attention to. And some of the stories that we had here, in fact, actually, we've been covering this story for several years. One of them is a health story on RF radiation and smart meters. Another one was published in the UK on PowerWatch. And, in fact, the Europeans have the longest long-term studies about the effects of things like cell phones. And the data coming in is not promising for human health. Some have gone so far as to say that the use of cell phones is maybe the next, you know, it's going to turn into the next problem like cigarettes were decades ago. Others, of course, say that that's overstated. But the bigger point and I think this is why we are so interested in these kinds of stories, is that there's something called the precautionary principle, and it's something that we may take into account when being exposed so ubiquitously to these new technologies. And in fact, there's a journal on environmental health that studied. There's this study, it was called Using Hill Viewpoints from 1965 for Evaluating Strengths of Evidence of the Risk for Brain Tumors Associated with the Use of Mobile and Cordless Phones. Now, granted, that doesn't just roll off the tongue, but we have it sourced at our website, projectcensored.org, and we urge people to actually go and read these studies. The corporate news media rarely even covers the fact that these studies have been done. And one of the reasons is big telecom, pumps a lot of money into advertising, owns the rights to leases for the news media in the first place. So they tend not to call attention to areas where they may, in fact, be potentially selling something that's hazardous to the public. By the way, much like people don't read the small print and the 40 pages of the iTunes agreement before they're clicking agree,
mm-hmm.
People are signing up to these cell phone contracts, which means they accept all the agreements. And if you read the fine print on the manual that comes with your phone, they'll tell you right in there. These are written by teams of medical experts and lawyers as well as industry insiders. And they say you're never supposed to hold the phone next to your body. You're never supposed to put it next to your head. There are reasons for that, for liability purposes, because they suspect it's not necessarily going to be a good thing in the long term. And last point, some countries like France have outlawed Wi-Fi in classrooms where there are young children. So, there are serious movements addressing this precautionary principle as we move forward. Not that we don't benefit potentially from this great technology as a communication tool and teaching tool, but there are costs with it, and we don't always know what they are. And we think that people should know more about these and be asking more of these kinds of questions. And I hope asking more about the phone carriers and phone manufacturers and their local media outlets as to why they won't report these kinds of stories.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So another one, number 13 on the list. Lawsuit challenges nuclear power industry immunity from liability in nuclear accidents. What's going on?
This is just another Fukushima story. Yeah. This is Fukushima, 350-plus people outside Japan, including 38 people from Fukushima. There's almost 1,500 plaintiffs. This lawsuit has been green-lighted. There is another lawsuit going on against TEPCO by U.S. naval officers on the Ronald Reagan because they couldn't sue the Navy, and they were one of the first responders to the Fukushima disaster, and many of them are now sick with cancers and dying from radiation exposure. This specific story, however, looks at TEPCO and tries to hold accountable the companies of Toshiba, Hitachi, and General Electric. Because they're the ones that were historical manufacturers and then now operators. So Toshiba and Hitachi have bought the rights to these equipment, and basically these folks are trying to hold them accountable for using both dangerous and faulty equipment, claiming that it is in fact safe, built on fault lines when it is not. There have been so many horrible stories coming out of Fukushima, Japan. We just did a whole show on it again a couple of weeks ago. And the things that are going on with Fukushima radiation, the fact that there is Fukushima radiation now being measured off the coast of California, it shows that it's an ongoing human health problem. It's an ongoing environmental problem. One area where people seem to pay more attention is how this radiation, we're talking about hundreds of tons of water a day, radioactive water being flushed into the Pacific Ocean. And one of the areas where people will pay attention to this is because it's wrecking fisheries, and it's starting to wreck the fishing economy. And, of course, that's how some people start to pay closer attention, is they're like, wow, this is going to really wreak havoc on livelihood of people if people can't eat radioactive fish. But the bigger problem, of course, is this kind of radioactive contamination ultimately isn't going to be good for anybody. I would like to say that in California, we don't have to be alarmist about the radiation from Fukushima because it's not really here in extraordinarily dangerous levels, although it's here off the coast. But the people in Japan are really on the front line of this problem. TEPCO has been abysmal of taking responsibility for it. They're now claiming they can't really contain the radiation. And essentially, they don't know what to do. For a long time, the Japanese government worked to censor any information coming out of Fukushima, coming out of Japan, to protect TEPCO, to protect the companies. And more we see that that's not possible. This is an international problem, and if we don't act quickly to try to deal with nuclear power, we've covered this for years, the fairy tale, the myth of safe and clean nuclear power. It takes tons and tons of carbon fuel to create nuclear power plants in the first place. There's nowhere to really store nuclear waste. It's touted as an alternative to fossil fuels. That's absurd. It's dangerous. It is not something at this point that the technology exists where we can make it efficiently. And if it weren't for government subsidization of the nuclear power industry, it would not exist, because no private entity will ensure the safety of a nuclear power plant. So it's another one of those issues where we privatize the gains and the profits and socialize the losses.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really associated with nuclear power. And I know some people think that it's a possibility in the future, maybe in the very distant future, the fusion future, I don't know. But the way in which nuclear power has been proliferated around the globe presently is not safe. Three Mile Island, Chernobyl have shown us that. Now, again, we see it taking place with Fukushima, and we think that it's something that people should be taking far more seriously.
All right. All right, so moving along, number 10 on the list, World Health Organization suppresses report on Iraqi cancers and birth defects. And presumably this is tied to some of the materials we've left there, particularly depleted uranium and perhaps other things.
White phosphorus, depleted uranium, toxic burn pits, the fact, another previously censored story, that the Pentagon is the world's largest polluter, largest consumers of fossil fuel and oil. In addition to that, we have a long history of nuclear and toxic dumping and nuclear testing in the Marshall Islands, Bikini Islands, all over the place. This is yet another example of U.S. foreign policy gone awry, where we now are showing record numbers of cancer cases and birth defects in Iraq. We already saw that in Vietnam after Monsanto and Agent Orange, and now we're seeing it here. The WHO, the World Health Organization, is actually trying to sit on evidence, to not release evidence that the U.S. military is using depleted uranium because it's illegal. Also white phosphorus. Both of these were used in Fallujah. And these have serious long-term negative health effects. And I would like to add again, for the same reason as I mentioned before, with the fisheries and so on, often people won't pay attention to these stories until they think it affects them or affects their pocketbook or what have you. This is a story that not only is affecting people in Iraq, but it's affecting U.S. personnel that are in Iraq and are subject to these same toxic carcinogenic materials. These materials do not know Iraqis from Americans. All they know is people, and when they attack people and people's systems, people develop cancer and they die. It's a very serious problem that is, of course, the product of our warfare. Again, we saw it in Vietnam. We see the toxic waste in the Ronald Reagan incident in Fukushima. Now we see it here again in Iraq. This, by the way, comes on the heels of something referred to as Gulf War Syndrome from the first Gulf War, and we long covered that at Project Censored. And many of the cases of what looks to be called Gulf War Syndrome is radiation poisoning, and that, of course, could be because of depleted uranium and other things, but the military doesn't really want to cop to it, and the WHO doesn't really want to let it get out. But in Iraq right now, boy, there's a lot of adult cancers and an serious increase in birth defects that people are suggesting is part of the U.S. war legacy there.
And the World Health Organization, is that a typical strategy for them to repress information from getting out? Or
I would say that it's occasional based on who it embarrasses, who it puts on the line for liability, how provable some of these things are. And in some instances, you could credit the WHO with doing some really important things or some good things. In other cases, maybe not. You know, this story was published by ZNET originally, and they were the ones that were talking about so it goes back to a March 2013 report, a high-ranking military official, a Iraqi government official at the Ministry of Health, discussed this issue with the BBC. And, basically they're saying that there's a rise in birth defects and cancers in Iraq. We're studying this right now. Why is this being kept a secret? It's a health emergency, and something needs to be done with it. Well, the WHO report had 58 scientists, and you know they were writing. They were saying, why aren't you going to release this report? You know, they wrote the WHO, and, you know, there was no response to the letter, and that was 2013. So this is, again, a real problem. And when you add to the mix, of course, that these are people that are victims of warfare, and these are people in countries of color, there just seems to be a lack of global interest in marshaling support for these kinds of victimized populations. And we think it's a travesty, and we think it's a direct violation of human rights, and it's against international law, and something should be done about it.
Yeah. All right, let's move on. Number eight, corporate news. We're counting down Project Censored's list, 25 underreported news stories. We're focusing, of course, on EcoRadio KC on the environmental ones. So number eight, corporate news ignores connections between extreme weather and global warming. All right, what do you want to tell us about that?
That's a really important story. Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, Media Watchdog Group, has called attention to this. The way in which the news, the corporate news media, tend to cover issues surrounding severe weather is absent any context of the scientific consensus surrounding global warming. And it's only a handful of supposed scientists that work for front groups like the Heartland Institute, funded by Exxon and others, that say that global warming is a hoax. It's not really happening. I mean, you take a look at several of the stories we have on climate change and global warming this year, including the number one story on ocean acidification increasing at an unprecedented rate. These are real stories. These are not the figments of someone's imagination. These are stories. In fact, every week almost that goes by, you see another scientific study saying that things are worse regarding the climate than we previously anticipated. I mean, this is the kind of thing that's happening. And what Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting called out, which we think was very important, was that when the corporate news media report about extreme weather, they almost never talk about climate change. You know, and Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting did a study of this, and only two of 114 extreme weather reports on CBS actually connected greenhouse gases, global warming, and severe weather. So it's something that's known, it's something about which there is scientific consensus, yet it is a fact that never seems to crop up in many of these discussions about severe weather on corporate media outlets. And in fact, the BBC recently decided that they would no longer give equal time to alleged scientific figures that deny global warming exists. So they stopped the false balancing problem. Still here in the United States, places like Fox News will give an entire afternoon to the head of weather.com or what have you to deny that this is a real problem. Again, we're like ostriches with our heads in the sand. This is a problem. It's everyone's problem. And everyone from Yes Magazine to Tom Dispatch to Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting are calling attention not only to media bias, but the fact that people don't, you know, these kind of outlets have so many conflicts of interest with big oil and fossil fuel industries that they won't even report about areas where there is massive scientific consensus. Growing fossil fuel use is related to global warming. We've got a huge methane gas cloud over the four corners of the United States. We've got gyres in the Pacific Ocean polluting it. I mean, again, here, we're on borrowed time, and we're borrowing the time of future generations. And given what we know now, it seems almost criminal, some might argue, that we are able to somehow continue to kick this can down the road into the future. We need to address climate change now. We're in a sixth stage of mass extinction on the planet. And, you know, these are real issues. This is not hocus pocus. This is not some liberal fantasy. These are hard facts that show that we face serious challenges in the time ahead. And it's going to mean food shortages. Nafees Ahmed has written about new food riots. People are going to be rioting over lack of water, lack of food, and it's going to be what the wars of the 21st century may ultimately be fought about.
Okay. All right. Well, that brings us, we were at number eight, but now we don't see an environmental story until number one, but it's the number one story of the year. Ocean acidification increasing at unprecedented rate. First of all, why is that the number one story?
Well, we have a series of judges that are media experts that look at all the stories we do every year, and we look at the hundreds of stories we research, and we let our professor participants and judges weigh in and vote on which ones they find to be most factually compelling and most significant in the big picture, and we rank them as the top 25. I mean, to be honest with you, I think ocean acidification increasing at an unprecedented rate is an alarming number one story. I think it's a very important issue that people should know a lot more about. But, you know, seriously, if you take a look at the stories that are on the Project Censored list every year, and you can see that at projectcensored.org all the way back to 1976, that all of the stories are ultimately very important and very significant. But in the last several years, I have to say that we have seriously ramped up our attention to these environmental stories because they are stories that tend to affect everybody. And look, we're talking about studies that are published here from the Proceedings of the Royal Society B to the 2013 Arctic Ocean Acidification Assessment. We're talking about scientific papers measuring CO2 levels in the ocean. We're talking about ocean acidification, how it affects sea life, how it all, and again, we're right back to this issue with humans. When it affects our pocketbook and when it's going to deplete the North Atlantic or North Pacific fishery, you know, all of a sudden people are like, oh my God, that's terrible. Well, what's even worse is what's creating that problem, right? Ocean acidification is something that's very terrible. It's something that's then going to emit even more CO2. It's going to cause more global warming. It's going to connect more to potential sea level rise. And look, this is a serious problem that we all face in the next 100 years. Now, maybe you and I won't be here in 100 years, mm-hmm. but the Earth will be, and people on it are going to have some serious, serious challenges. As Craig Welch wrote in the Seattle Times, one of the few corporate outlets that actually covered this story, he wrote that combined nationwide spending on acidification research for 8 federal agencies, including grants to university science by the National Science Foundation, totals $30 million a year. That's less than the annual budget for coastal Washington City of a population of 10,000 people. I mean, so we're not really throwing a lot of serious resources into studying this problem, regardless of the fact that we know that it has massive extenuating circumstances 30 years into the future. So this is, and it does affect the fisheries, it does affect the economy. So we were hoping that this story would get more attention than Science Now, the Seattle Times, and Mother Jones. And again, it did get some coverage in Newsweek magazine after our book went to press, but they haven't followed up on it. They haven't done any follow-up, and it's sort of just languishing out there somewhere on the internet. But we hope people take these environmental concerns more seriously, because collectively we need to face these challenges if we're to overcome them.
Yeah, thank you. It was great to step through this list with you. Now, I think Natural E has a question or two for you, if that's okay, Mickey.
Sure, absolutely. My pleasure.
Hi, I just wanted to ask, if you had to write a story to get at the overarching theme or that the huge silent reason that all these stories are censored from 1976 to now, in the first place, how would it begin? Like, what would it cover?
Well, I mentioned earlier in the interview that you know, back in the 1980s, there were about 50 corporations that tended to control the media outlets in the United States. And Ben Bagdikian, then dean of journalism at Berkeley Graduate School in journalism, wrote a book called Media Monopoly. And he was basically canary in the coal mine, saying, look, we're losing diversity. Conglomeration and deregulation are going to come, and they're going to really have a winnowing effect on the information that people have access to. Here we sit in 2014, and about 6 corporations control 90% of the media in the United States. And, of course, if you go back and look at the classic work by Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman, Manufacturing Consent on the Political Economy of Mass Media, that was, again, in 1988, they listed 5 major issues that affect the way news media can be reported, and they referred to it as a propaganda model. Mm-hmm. And the first was ownership. Who owns the media ultimately affects what is and is not reported. And closely related to that, number 2, is advertising dollars. Since we live in a society that's capitalist, and these agencies make their profits, these news outlets make their profits as part of media corporations through advertising, advertising tends to, through fear or favor, often determine what does get reported, what doesn't get reported based on ad revenues. And that's a real serious problem. And those are two of the more serious things that impact the way in which news is reported. Of course, dating back to the propaganda model, there also is this, the reliance on official sources, which brings a serious lack of diversity to the alleged public airwaves, because we only hear from institutional or official sources, and we don't often get to hear sources that will challenge those official narratives, which is very necessary as a free speech, free press issue in the United States. And then the others are flack, feedback, and boycotting that can affect what people get reported. And the last is ideological bias. And in the United States, the biggest ideological proclivity outside of nationalism and sort of this war on terrorism style of patriotism is the fact that the United States is a capitalist economy, and that basically cannot be challenged above all else. And those are some serious impediments that really encroach upon doing actual fact-based, objective, and critical journalism.
Well, thank you for answering that question. And I would also just wonder also why these are stories even to begin with. You know, why is the ocean acidifying? Why do we have this extreme weather? You know, I mean, I know the reasons why. I know the reasons.
Right,
why,
right.
But I mean that's the world we live in. That we live in this world where these few corporations are ruining it, and the rest of us are left here scraping together the news so we can get it together and get it out there. And but thank you very much for the work that you do, Mickey, because it's very important. And Project Censored, I'm glad that this is started in 1976 and you're still doing the work that you do. And I invite our listeners to go to projectcensored.org and check out their top 25 most underreported news list that they have. And they have a DVD and a book that they publish. So, please check that out.
Thank you very much, yes. Mickey. We really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today.
Thanks so much. It's great to be on with you all in Kansas City, and I wish you a great week and a great rest of the year.
All right. Happy Thanksgiving to you, too.
All best right. To you.
Bye-bye.
All right. This is Natural Lee, and I have your events. Let's see. The Downtown Bike Network Open House. There'll be an open house held to present the plans of Kansas City, Missouri to add 13 miles of new bike lanes that will connect downtown to the West Side, East Side, West Bottoms, River Market, and Crossroads using Grand Boulevard as the system spine. The Crossroads Community Association is hosting the event. This free event will be held Tuesday, November 25th from 4 to 6 p.m. at Encompass at 1512 Grand Boulevard. And so that is tomorrow. And then on Wednesday, December 10th, from 4 to 6 p.m., the Environmental Management Commission promotes environmental awareness and resource efficiency to the city's leaders and staff to assist the progress of Kansas City towards sustainability. And the general public is encouraged to attend and observe meetings and to join and participate in its efforts. And this meeting is on December 10th, Wednesday, from 4 to 6. It's the Kansas City Environmental Management Commission. And that is all for our events.
We're going to go out with This Week in Water, updates on what's been going on in the world of water, right after these messages.
Support for 90.1 FM is provided by The Pitch. Do you need a gift for the foodie, socialite, and music lover on your gift list this holiday season? The Pitch Passport includes 5 parties for the price of 1 in 2015, including Sugar Rush, Vodka Vodka, Taste of KC, The Pitch Music Showcase, and The Pitch Music Awards. There are only 100 passports available, and when they're gone, they're gone. For more information, visit pitch.com or call 816-561-6061.
Why are large numbers of children leaving their home countries in South America and immigrating to the United States? Could current U.S. policy be a root cause of this mass migration? Judy Ansel, president of the Cross Border Network, will connect the dots on the All Souls Forum this Wednesday at noon right here on KKFI.
The Keystone Pipeline is an act of war this November 23rd, 2014.
I'm Franny Halperin.
And I'm Jamie Sudler.
And it's This Week in Water.
Seconds after the U.S. Senate failed by one vote last Tuesday to pass a bill that would have advanced construction of the Keystone XL, a Native American chant broke out in the gallery, celebrating the rejection of the controversial crude oil pipeline.
A huge block of those opposed to the Keystone XL are Native American tribes from Montana, South Dakota, and Nebraska. Leaders from eight tribes in the Great Sioux Nation maintain that tar sands oil threatens to pollute their land, areas that sit on top of the Ogallala Aquifer, a major source of agricultural and drinking water for the Great Plains states.
The tribes warned that as sovereign nations, they would close their borders to pipeline construction, adding that they'll do whatever it takes, including spilling blood to protect their, quote, sacred water. Rosebud Sioux President Cyril Scott had already declared House approval of the pipeline an act of war.
Republicans have vowed to make passage of the bill their first order of business come January when they control both houses of Congress.
When oil and gas drillers produce fuels from underground, they bring up more water than any other product, more water than gas or oil.
Based on data from the most recent year available, a Reuters report details how the industry produced 5 billion barrels of oil, but 55 million barrels of water. This equates to an average of 7.5 barrels of water for every barrel of crude.
This produced water is nasty stuff and contains salts and radioactive substances. Most of it is injected back into the ground, a process that can lead to earthquakes, but some of it is spread on roads and held in evaporation ponds. Last Tuesday, the San Diego City Council unanimously approved plans to recycle sewage into drinking water. The project, dubbed, quote, Pure Water San Diego, was hailed by business and environmentalists alike as the best way to reduce rising costs for imported water, create a drought-proof supply, and protect the coastal city's marine environment. San Diego currently dumps untreated sewage into the ocean.
Concerns about a public backlash and an ooh factor prompted the city to spend $1 million on education and outreach. Polling suggests increased support, but a handful of residents spoke in opposition to the plan, citing costs as well as environmental concerns that toxins, such as those from prescription medications, could be left lingering in the water.
Water rates are expected to drop as the water recycling allows San Diego to buy less imported water, which currently makes up 85% of its total water supply.
Lakes in North America are facing a jelly problem. Not something like grape jelly, but jellification of insect species. And while we all like jelly on our toast, we may not want it in our lakes.
A study done by Queen's University has shown that declining calcium levels is hindering the survival of aquatic organisms. The low calcium leads to the growth of jelly-clad species, which have been increasing in alarming rates.
More jellified species leads to altering food chains, but also the little jelly-encapsulated insects can actually clog water intakes. The increase of jelly species in lakes is likely due to acid rain, according to researchers. The Gila River in New Mexico is one of the last remaining free-flowing rivers in the country. However, there's an effort underway to divert parts of the river for use in southwestern New Mexico. That part of the state suffers from a lack of available water resources.
Critics claim that diverting water from the Gila is too expensive, up to $1 billion, and environmentally damaging for the relatively small amount of water it would yield. The New Mexico agency with authority to approve the project will likely vote on it on Monday, November 23rd.
A former state water engineer has stated that the proposed diversion would barely work, even assuming the best conditions. According to him, seepage and evaporation rates from the diversion could yield little or no water for southwestern New Mexico. And finally, Britain's first biobus hit the road last Thursday, powered entirely by human waste and food scraps.
The aptly nicknamed Poo Bus can travel more than 186 miles on a single tank of gas. The fuel is created by breaking down sewage with bacteria in an anaerobic digester.
The butt of many jokes on social media, its engineers may well have the last laugh, as the bus produces fewer emissions than traditional diesel engines and is both renewable and sustainable.
How much human waste does it take to run the bus, you ask? They say each of us produces enough, number two, every year to fuel the bus for 37 miles.
And to your second question, no, the poo doesn't stink. This Week in Water is a production of H2O Radio and is sponsored by Colorado WaterWise. Learn more at coloradowaterwise.org.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Están escuchando KKFI 90.1 FM Kansas City, Radio de la Comunidad. You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City.